Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. I'm very pleased to have a special guest, Julia Vaughan Smith. Julia is an executive coach, a supervisor, previously a psychotherapist, and she's authored three books. The first, Coaching and Trauma, the second, From Therapist to Coach, and the third book, which is to be published on the 3rd of April this year, is called Daughters, How to Untangle Yourself from Your Mother. And that's what we want to discuss today. Tomorrow's Women's Day, so it's a good subject to have. Julia, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
Thank you very much. I'm fine, thank you. Yeah, just a small point. My first book was Therapist to Coach. The second is Coaching and Trauma.
Okay, good.
I'm fine. I'm really pleased to be here. And thank you very much for inviting me on. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, well, I was intrigued. So I guess the first question is just to find out kind of what motivated you to write a book called How to Untangle Yourself from Your Mother.
Well, there were several things, really. I had, for the last 15, 18 years, I've been very involved in developing my understanding, both as a person and a practitioner, about emotional attachment trauma and how that comes. So, first of all, it came through that and trying to deepen understanding about how contact with a mother from conception onwards has a lasting impact on. And I took the daughter because I'm a daughter. It's a topic I know. So we could say there's another book about sons, but not for me to write. So there was that. And also, I had been very interested in the work of Marion Woodman about the death mother archetype, and currently written about by Dr. Daniela Seif. So those two things came together. And of course, there was my own relationship with my mother that I wanted to do some working through. So it came through from those sort of three directions, really. I wanted to understand something. That's why I write books, to understand something. And I changed a lot in the process of doing it as well.
Good. So we'll explore that. And it's interesting to me. I mean, I was a family therapist for many years, and mother and daughter relationships were clearly something very special, often very intense and enmeshed in some families. So this notion of untangling oneself is it of deep interest to me. So let's explore some of your findings and then go on to how you've changed yourself through this process.
Okay. I suppose I come at it through, so I've used the concept of entanglement, mm-hmm. you know, a relationship that's a bit got a bit like a sticky web, that we're tied together. And what I noticed talking to many daughters was that as adults, they were setting themselves up to continually suffer. So this sticky web took them back to the same patterns over and over and over, and that they continued also to blame the mother for. But as adults, they were also part of the dynamic. So that was one of the images and the concepts I use in this idea that from conception onwards, our relationship with our mother is an intense one. I mean, we're in it for 9 months, and unless we are, then, you know, if it's IVF or different things. But there is so that connection, and we are part of her system in utero, and then we are very dependent as infants. So and I look at how then other life events change or affect our relationship with the mother, including, of course, what's the family structure, the family system around us, what family system are we embedded in as two people? What's the role of father? Is he present? Is he not present? What about siblings, grandparents? So all of that makes a big difference. And we all know that mothering actually is challenging and difficult for many mothers. And if they have support, then it's help. They are greatly helped. But if they don't, it's a much different thing. So that's where I came into it. And so that's the concept of untangling yourself, trying to find a way to change our own inner narrative and our own patterns to take ourselves back into ourselves rather than continually looking to our mother for something that she's not able to give us.
Yeah, so the mother is such a powerful word. I mean, it evokes many things, and in different cultures it invokes kind of different things. Even when I worked in working class Liverpool, there was like large Catholic families I worked with quite often. Mm. And it's culturally quite different to their expectations of what it was to be a mother and daughter to where I was born, even in Bristol, 200 miles down the road. It was there's differences. And then in much other cultures. Did you find some of that in your research and your work?
I did a bit, although I, to be honest, I wasn't taking a wide world view of it. So, and I acknowledge that wasn't what I set out to write. But I'm not so much thinking about the concept of mothering. It's the direct experience of the direct caring, which often is the mother, not always, obviously, and the importance of that primary relationship on the daughter. And many people can contribute to mothering. So how we connect and attach to people, we can obviously in families that operate differently, a different thing happens. But I'm talking much more, I suppose, about what happens at the level of neurophysiology with our closest caregiver. Not always the mother, but mostly the mother, and the impact that has on the child. So I wasn't looking at, wasn't taking a sort of a more societal view of it. I was looking at what happens to the neurophysiology, understanding there are many very different variations on families, very different variations on parenting and the expectations and all of that.
Yeah, I guess that leaves me with a question, because for me, that intimate connection you talk about and the neuropsychology and is also socially constructed. There's also like there's no mother and daughter without a society around it. So how one makes sense of that relationship and what kind of that does to you, you know, what your expectations are as a mother and what your expectations are as a daughter and your perceptions about how you're being treated and how you engage are shaped by the culture around you. Yeah,
absolutely. Of course, absolutely. And that's right. And particularly, I think, you know, different cultures and different families even have very different expectations about what's expected of a mother and a daughter. But mothers are put under incredible pressure by the context in which they're living about how they're supposed to mother. And it's not a good fit. For some it is. But for others, it's not a good fit at all. So the shame and the internal responses to that, I think, are really, really hard, and therefore affect how you can relate to and be in emotional contact to a child.
Sure. Did you do interviews? How did you get your data for your book?
I did. It's not an academic book. I'm not pretending it's an academic book. I interviewed 25 women. They were mostly age 40 or over. They were all volunteers, so I didn't set out to get a coherent sample. That wasn't what I was setting out to do. So, you know, there's many other books that could be written in a different way to do that. What I've noticed is that it's when women get to an older age, or 40, middle age, things have changed. They've got through a phase of career advancement or children raising, and there's something else that they're also trying to resolve in their lives. So I found that's where a lot of the main issues were. And of course, as mothers get older, the risk of entanglement is even greater as the daughters, certainly in the society I grew up, and I know it's not the same everywhere, were often expected to be the carer, particularly the unmarried daughter.
I studied psychoanalysis through sort of Melanie Klein and those kind of object relation theorists, and they talk about kind of the father entering the close dyad of the mother and the daughter. And what was your kind of experience of that, of like a third person to and it doesn't have to be a male figure.
No,
it can be, you know, you can have gay parents, you can have
absolutely
a third coming in to kind of separate that entanglement. Did you?
I think, well, clearly it's very important, and it's where, so, and also that a loving present father can offset the impact on a daughter of a mother who can't be loving and present for all sorts of reasons to do with her own situation, her own psychology. So that can be an incredibly balancing, loving presence. So we learn about being loved and loving ourselves and being protected from this other person. So very important presence. In a lot of cases, or as I say, a mother's partner, somebody equally balanced there, add something else with the dynamic. And there's a different support within the family cohesion. And I think, you know, in terms of maternal ambivalence and things, I think grandparents, grandmothers are also a very important factor. So there's all sorts of other factors there make a huge difference. Unfortunately, it's when the third person isn't able to provide that, or has other agendas going, and sometimes daughters can turn to that third person seeking refuge, but only to be seduced and entangled within there as well. But yes, I mean, I don't come from the same psychodynamic route as you, but it is absolutely, you know, who else is around. For all of us, it's really important, isn't it, who we grew up with. I mean, my father died when I was 9. It had a huge impact on my life, not just the loss of a father, but the loss of a third figure. In my life like that, and
I think it's very important. And you know, the cross-generational, when I was a family therapist working in cross-generational ways, so
absolutely,
it just seemed to be so important to get grandparents in the room wherever we could, because they were, you could really kind of start reading patterns and seeing how the mother entanglement with the daughter was kind of also a part of the kind of the grandparents entanglement, and it gets passed on and on, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And as a family therapist, you're a wonderful position to see all that. I mean, I'm not. So you would have got a very rich experience in that. But obviously, ancestral trauma, it's passed on down through the generations, how we bond, how we connect, what's happened to us in our the lives that we then take into our parenting and to our desire to have a child in the first place. Yeah, absolutely. It's You can't just look at, you know, it is a systemic thing. One can't just look at just two people, mother and daughter. You have to see them within the context, as you're saying, exactly as you're describing, both within the context of their family system, but also, as you said earlier, in the context of their cultural system. We have to see things in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, it's...
It's very, very interesting. And you said earlier on that you went through a change process during this. Do you want to share something about
that? Yeah, I will. I mean, when I started off, I thought, oh, this is going to bring up a lot of issues for me. I originally tried to find some therapy help, but wasn't able to do that. So I had to do my own sort of deep reflection process going as I was writing, and which I found deeply valuable. And as I was working through, it became so clear for my own reflective processes, so clear that I was carrying my own false narrative about many things. Mm-hmm. And that if I challenge those in my own situation, things change within me. So a greater capacity for honouring and compassion for myself and my mother, who was not in any way cruel or abusive or neglectful in any way, but through which we didn't connect terribly well. And I could see as an adult, I could understand. So I'd already had some understanding about how that had come about from childhood, from the circumstances, that I came to the conclusion at the end that actually we were locked together by grief. Mm-hmm. There'd been an awful lot of grief in our family, huge amount of grief, a lot of it not processed, not just my father dying, but a whole lot of other stuff as well that I think hadn't been processed. So that became much clearer to me as I worked with that. But also as I came towards the end of the book and I was trying to find what, you know, think through what is the way out of this because just stopping, you know, if we could just stop, we would just stop. So it's not that easy. But some of this, some of it's understanding, but actually it's about honouring and respecting ourselves. It's about taking responsibility for ourselves as adults, about deciding what sort of relationship we want now, and finding and being able to take back our wishful thinking that if I continue to behave in this way, my mother will become the person I want her to be. Yeah. Well, if she'd been able to do that, she'd done that a long time ago. And we can then be compassionate that she can't do that. And as adults, we can look to ourselves. Mm-hmm. We can find within ourselves our own love and compassion for ourselves. And that sort of changed as well. So what changed for me is I found a very welcome depth of deep compassionate connection with my mother.
Yeah, that's important.
Which I was grateful for.
Still alive, or she passed?
She's not. She actually died 7 years ago today.
Okay. That's a synchronistic date.
Yes.
We're talking about that, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I think that's very interesting. I mean, both my parents have died, and what I've experienced is, you know, developmentally, I mean, again, developmentally as a daughter or a son, in relation to your parents, you know, you're changing, you know, you go from infants to kind of childhood to adolescence to young adulthood to kind of middle age adulthood. And, you know, that my relationship changed, you know, through those periods as I became more aware, and but I could see really that you had clear choices. You know, if you, you know, I have been in therapy a lot, and look to myself, and you know, that there's all of us have entanglements with our parents, and thinking about it, I could see I had clear choices to make around how I chose to relate to them. Like, you know, some things you desire your parents to change, and if only they were this, and if only they were that, if only they'd given me this, and you can get into blame relationships, you get into kind of feeling like a victim. You know, my childhood wasn't easy, there's lots went on, we had loss in the family, but I could see moments of change. But what interested me was that even now that they've passed away, I'm still in relationship to them.
Yes.
And I still have to kind of make choices around, you know, do I blame my father for this? Do I blame my mother for this? Or do I relate to it differently? You know, do I accept that they had a really tough life? Like, you know, they were really kind of young ages. They didn't have good parent figures themselves. You know, they did a pretty good job, really, considering, you know. So, but that relationship's still there, and I still have kind of I still talk to my mother in my mind. Mm. Still very present.
Yeah, I think that's it's really interesting to hear you say that, and I think that is true. And I think entanglement goes on beyond death. I mean, as you say, it's the, for me, my premise is that it's emotional trauma that holds us together. So hers and mine coming together, and what's in the system. But I think that's right. I think blame is part of entanglement.
Yes. Yeah.
I think it's part of the entanglement, and it keeps us entangled.
Yeah.
So different. Now, there are mothers and fathers who have been very cruel and abusive to their children. So they can be held responsible for that. And if we wish, we can hold a place of compassion that they, you know, their history took them to that place. But nonetheless, we can hold a responsibility that they harmed us very much. It wasn't my situation. But I think to blame, this sort of running blame, they let me down, they didn't do this, they didn't do the other, actually is to just stay entangled. And I wish they'd done this and I wish they'd done that. It's to stay entangled. And I found for myself that I noticed a pattern that I used to make sort of jokey things, which about how my mother sometimes talked with me, that would sort of put her in a bad light and me in a sort of suffering place. And I thought, why am I doing that?
Yes.
Why on earth am I still doing that? This is ridiculous. This is just keeping a narrative going that is nonsense. And so I stopped. That I did. I said, I'm stopping this now. And I have stopped it. And I think that was a freeing thing as well. It was just this sort of, poor me. Not so from a narcissistic place.
Yeah.
as I reran history.
And those narratives and or life scripts, some people call them, really hold you in a place which is quite difficult to move from, and then that impacts on your parenting or even your relationships to your close loved ones.
Yeah.
So trying to open up those scripts and not just be kind of entrapped by them is really,
It's really important. And, you know, I guess we have to find our own way. I mean, what did you find most helpful in doing that?
Noticing it. I mean, I've had lots of therapy and stuff, but so that does help. But that's not the only way. There's many other ways, you know, observing our relationships with others, I think, you know, and noticing how you get trapped into scripts. You know, it's like you just get trapped into saying things or thinking things and just noticing it really and kind of questioning it and being curious about it. Because not only do we not need to blame our parents, we need to try not to blame ourselves as well.
Absolutely.
We get caught up, you know.
We do.
You know, you can never be the perfect parent. There's lots of questions, you know, we have. I mean, one thing I noticed is that when I was a parent at a young age, I was a parent when I was 25 or 26, and I was a single parent, so I was with a son, and his mother and I co-parented, so we separated. Mm. It's very interesting because what shocked me was, you know, I decided I didn't want to be like my dad, and my father was a loving man. He had a lot of trauma. I lost a brother when I was quite young. I was 5, and I lost a brother when he was 7, and that impacted my father greatly. And there's a lot of things going on in the family. And it was a difficult kind of childhood in lots of ways. So I decided, you know, when I had my son, I was going to do it differently, like one does, you know. So I actually gave up work, and I spent 4 years at home with looking after this baby, and his mother was there for the first year, kind of down the road, and then she went to work, and we co-parented together. It's a very powerful experience. I thought I'd get bored as a parent. Some people kind of love parenting, and others don't. I just loved it. I just fell in love with this kind of idea of being with my son Finn, and. But at one stage, I just remember this voice came out of me and kind of spoke to Finn in a certain way. And I was like really shocked. It was like my father's voice. Suddenly my father's voice was speaking through me. And it was almost like a kind of an instinctual reaction to something. And I suddenly realized the power of kind of our parental kind of imprints within us and what we carry with us and how actually hard it is to separate from some of that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. I would share. Well, absolutely. I think it's observing and recognizing, and I think, you know, I see our learning about these things like being on a spiral going up. You know, that you come back to the same place and think, oh, I thought I resolved this, but actually do the work. You know, do some more work and come. But when you come back to it another time, you're not in exactly the same space.
No,
you have learned from when you were there last time. But like you say, you find these voices coming out, these imprints coming out, and you thought, oh, I thought I'd resolve that. But, oh, no, there's something else here I can do. So I think it is a sort of an ongoing. But but over time, I think things do get released, don't they? As you say, you know, both therapy, I think, you know, I've had quite a bit of therapy too. I think therapy helps, our own capacity for self-reflection helps, our own capacity to take responsibility for our own patterns and do what we can to change them, knowing that it might not be lasting, but we can come back and try again.
Yeah, and observing other people and like reading books like yours and you know, reading novels about parental relationships and stuff. I think all this is, you know, you don't have to just go to therapy. I think all this kind of informs you that there is different possibilities, different
Absolutely.
Ways.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I think there's all sorts of ways we can find our way through to understand and free ourselves from some of this the ties, the sort of the sticky bits that keep us locked together in an unhealthy. It's unhealthy. I mean, it takes away our energy. What I learned and I knew for myself is lots of daughters feel very resentful, they feel very dutiful, they feel very angry, they feel guilty for feeling what they feel, and there's not much space for joy.
I mean, another response to entanglement I noticed in family therapy was disassociation. So some people just were wrapped up in anger or kind of locked into in front of their mothers every day, and they'd be carrying this kind of enmeshment, this closeness, but they couldn't kind of escape it. And other people kind of would just disassociate. So that was also entanglement in the sense that they were just kind of running away from actually dealing with, but they carried within them, even though they disassociated, they carried within them these strong feelings you're saying of kind of anger or
absolutely. And they, you know, influence then how we are with others, don't they?
You know,
they're not just because they're sort of shut down with dissociation doesn't mean to say they're not there.
No, and you know, watching daughters and children make partner choices is so dependent on how you've worked through that relationship with your mother or your father. For sure.
Yes. And of course, we can be entangled with all sorts of people, as you've been suggesting too. You know, I mean, it's not, I've just chosen this one set of entanglement, but we can be entangled with partners, with our children, with, you know, all sorts of people we can become entangled with.
So through your experience of writing this book, I've been intrigued over the last, well, most of my adult life really, around roles. So I was a son of, we had four boys, and in many ways, I think I became my mother's daughter. I don't know, you know, I was quite a macho boy. I played rugby and kind of, I was a rough and tumble young man. But also, I became a nurse, and I became a therapist, you know, and I do the cooking, and I became a single parent, and that I can't help but observing that I took on these female kind of roles, and I know that my mother would have loved to have a daughter, and it's, but it left me kind of, you know, in those positions of being othered. You know, you're a male nurse in a female environment, you're a single parent, mother and baby club. It kind of, I've always questioned kind of gender roles and expectations. And today it seems, you know, young men and I wonder about women as well, around, there's a lot of talk of non-binary, of queer culture, many different ways to express yourself. But I also wonder kind of how people make sense of what they are supposed to be as a mother or a daughter. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I think it's really complicated, and I think that's what we're seeing now. Yeah. People trying to find different ways of being with this complexity. And I think it is. I think, of course, you know, I was born in the 50s. So, you know, parenting then and society then was very different to it is now. So position of women was very different. You know, we hadn't had the 70s wave of feminism, and it was a very different place to have been born into in middle-class England, white middle-class England. So I think it is that demands and expectations are enormous. I know on women, I'm sure it's exactly the same on sons and men as well. And also the space to find yourself. You know, often in families, we're not given that space. We're told who we're supposed to be, or we're encouraged to take up a role in the family, as you've clearly, you know, spoken of. We're encouraged to take up those positions by the system to keep the system operating or to please people. If we're not able to have enough space to really, really connect with who we are, how we experience ourselves inside. It's quite, I don't know how, it's all sorts of theories about that, I know it. But I think then we can become locked in these roles and feel we have no choice. But I think what's refreshing is some idea, actually, we do have choice. We can think about it. It's harder the older we get because things are set up. But I think it is... so many pressures, aren't there, about being so, you only have to see what women have, you know, and I suspect, you know, we're not, what we're allowed to do and not allowed to do before the press come down on us, you know.
Yeah, no, it's an entanglement in itself, really. I mean, like in some ways, I'm delighted there's so many more opportunities that people, you know, women and men can take on different roles, that they question kind of what gender stereotypes are. There's clearly been a lot of movement. And at the same time, there's kind of the converse pressure of like, you know, you should also be like this and you should also be like this. And it's I think it's a confusing muddle at the moment. I mean, I think in the 50s and 60s, there was much clearer roles which you could transgress or break away from. Whereas now there's kind of options, and yet there's kind of hidden agendas. Yeah. And like you say, women get put in their place if they step out.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a strange kind of a place we're in at the moment.
It is a strange place we're in all sorts of ways. It is a strange place. I'm going to see it as sort of a really transitional, something's changing around us, societal things are changing. So I think it is a strange place, and I think it will be very uncomfortable for a number of people for quite a while.
Yeah, and I hope also to open up some space so that, you know, people can actually move from kind of entrapped roles as well, you know, so within the discomfort there's opportunities. But yeah, so I'm a big fan of queer culture and hoping that we can queer society so that people can actually find themselves within.
Absolutely.
I love the support, doesn't it?
It does, and it needs many of us to do and work on ourselves so we can offer a safe space for people in that exploration.
Julia, we're coming to the end. I asked my guests a question at the end, two questions. One, just with all their life experience, what it means to live a good life and to create a good society. These are big questions, but just any thoughts at all on kind of what it means to live a good life and to create a good society?
For me personally, so I'll say personally, I think it's being really aware of myself, not in a narcissistic way, but in a way to ensure that my own responses to trauma that I have within are not being projected and acted out on others. I would say that's the same on society. So that leading a good life, being a good citizen, and is about self-regulation, mindful attention to what we are taking out in our behaviour and in our responses to people, to those closest to us and in the wider society, and how we other and exclude people, and to do what work we can to limit our capacity to do that.
That's very thoughtful. Julia, it's been a really interesting conversation, very thoughtful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.